So now I knew a lot about advertising, and I started writing a science fiction novel about advertising, which turned out to be The Space Merchants, which has done pretty well over the years.
Didn't see him cornered.
Yes. I wrote about a third of it.
Yeah.
And I showed it to Horace Gold at Galaxy. And he said, that's fine. I'm running an Alfie Bester serial now. When I finish it, I'll run this.
Oh, God.
And I said, have you noticed that it isn't finished? And he said, yes. Now, what do you deduce from that?
So, I like this. I'm going to run it next. Okay, that's part one.
So,
no pressure.
I was fortunate in that Cyril Cornbluth was staying with us right at that time. He'd been living in Chicago, but he'd come to visit. And Cyril and I had written a few short stories together before the war, and I showed him the first third and said, do you want to collaborate on this so we can get the damn thing written? And he said, sure. So he fiddled with the first part, and then he wrote the second part, which I fiddled with, and then the two of us wrote the end of it turn and turn about. He'd write a few pages, and I'd write a few pages. And it appeared as Baby Planet, and it worked pretty well.
Yeah.
And I was an agent at that time, so I thought, gee, maybe I can get it published as a book. I've been selling Hal Clement to the book people and Jack Williamson. Maybe I can sell this. So I submitted it to every book publisher in New York that had a science fiction line. By that time, there were maybe 8 or 9 of them. And they all bounced it.
Oh, my God.
For varying reasons. One of the editors...
Correct me if I'm wrong, but hasn't that been in print almost continuously since it finally appeared?
It indeed has.
So much for
all over
judgment.
The world.
Okay.
So one of them took me aside and said, look, Fred... you know, we're friends, so I'm going to be candid with you. This book is simply not of professional caliber. You need to get some professional writer to pull it together for you. Well, we never found a professional writer to pull it together. We found an amateur publisher. Ian had just started Ballantine Books. He didn't know it wasn't publishable. So, anyway... it is quite a success story, actually.
Yeah, and it's been in print ever since. It'll go away for a year or two now and again.
We sold the movie rights. It's been adapted. It's been a steady earner for a long time. But
so much for
I have a lot of fun. I run into some of those editors from time to time. And I managed to turn the conversation to the book.
To the 47th reprinting of the...
Yes.
The other thing you can just do is hold up the earnings statement for the book. Damn. That's good.
They sold the movie rights, unfortunately, shortly after Cyril's death, but I got an offer for movie sale from an outfit in England called Rediffusion Television, which was going to go into the feature film production business. And they offered, I think, $7,500 for the film rights. So I turned it over to my agent, who was at that time a man named H.N. Swanson, who was a legend in the film business. He had represented everybody. Why he was representing me, I don't know. And he got in touch with them, and he called me up, and he said, they're offering $10,000, but that's ridiculous. And I said, well, you're the agent, Swanee. You do what you want to do. And then he called me up again and said, we're up to $17,500, but I don't want to sign for that. And I said, yeah. And then the producers... began to get into the act. They began calling me up. At the time, I was on a lecture tour, and they'd follow me around the country saying, he's going to blow it. We can't go any higher. And I would say to them, leave me alone. He's my agent. Talk to him. And finally, he called me up, and he said, we're up to $50,000. You want to try for $100,000? And I said, Swanee, you're breaking my heart. You're the agent. Tell me what to do. He said, well, we'll take the $50,000. So he did.
What year was that?
55 or so. When $50,000 was mine.
That would buy a house.
$50,000 would buy a whole block of houses. It was like maybe $250,000 or maybe more than that now.
Yeah. And the producers had been saying, we won't go any higher at about 17.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, that's why I've
so
learned...
so much for producers.
That's why I've learned to let an agent deal. I knew this, having been an agent, but it was different when it was my own story. And they were talking larger amounts of money than I was used to dealing with when I was selling stories to John Campbell.
Yeah.
Although I'd sold movie rights on a couple of stories for my various writers and a lot of books.
Yeah, it's a shame that's never been made into a movie. It's just been
still floating around. Yeah. Well, I think it's academic now because I think the final copyright extension runs out in a couple of years. I'm not sure just when.
Does it, or they've been revising the copyright
law? No, but they haven't for the stuff that was published before the first revision.
Oh.
It was then 28 years plus 28 years, which means 56, and it was published in 53, so 56, yeah. 2009, it's history.
Oh. Oy.
I don't mind. I mean, I've been paid for it once.
Sounds like you've been paid more than once. Well, also, it was turned into a radio drama.
Oh, yes.
Or a Galaxy.
It was in the CBS Theater of the Air or something like that. One of the prestigious ones.
Yeah, well, also Galaxy Magazine.
NBC had, what did they call it?
I am blanking on the name as we sit here talking, but it was X-1 Dimension.
X-1.
Yeah. That was done with Galaxy Magazine.
Right. And might have still been going on, except that the publisher, Bob Gwynn, said, you know what? We could make more money out of television. And we won't do that as long as they're doing radio. So he canceled the radio contract and sat waiting for the television contract, which never came.
Well, the problem is, I mean, if you do it on television, especially talking about doing Galaxy Magazine on television in the early 1950s, the production cost, the limited special effects, all the other technical limitations of doing television made it impossible to do many of the stories that appeared in the magazine, or at least to do them without it being humorous.
They did as best they could, though. There was a...
But doing it on radio meant you had an unlimited special effects budget. Just
and they did a fine job, too.
Oh, those were incredibly...
That was the time when the dramatic radio field was dying because television was where you got sitcoms and stuff like that. But the networks, the radio networks, had all these high-priced writers on contract, and they turned them over to X-1 because otherwise they were doing nothing. So we had some of the best writers in the business doing those stories.
Yeah, and what they were doing, though, was adaptations of real science fiction.
That's right.
And there is a difference in the aesthetic, a difference in the viewpoint, any number of differences that you can find between written science fiction and any other kind of science fiction.
Hmm.
What impressed me was when they did the adaptations, they did them honestly. They didn't just keep the title and...
That's right. They did a good job. They still appear from time to time. There's a radio program in Chicago called Those Were the Days or something like that, which does old radio dramas and including occasionally some of the X-1 stuff.
I was just up on eBay a few weeks ago and found someone who had done a compilation of the entire run of X-1 and done them as MP3 files, and it was like two or three CDs, and it had every... I haven't double-checked, but it has like every... show ever done on two or three CDs. And I'm sure the person who was distributing them did not have the rights to distribute them.
I'm sure they don't, yeah.
And it's like I care. It's one of the few times that I really didn't care about was this authorized or whatever. It's just like, here was my chance to get all of them at once.
Yeah, and well, they don't really have the rights. They shouldn't be doing them, and this radio program shouldn't be doing them either.
Yeah.
But it's...
I wish the
life's too short to worry about it.
Well, and I wish the people that actually had the rights would actually do something with them.
That would be nice, too. Yeah.
You know, they're just sitting on them, and it's like, do something. Which is why when this person had up on eBay, you know, CDs with every Dimension X and X-1 and a bunch of other stuff, it's like, this is too cool to pass up. And so, you know, I've got a CD that has like a year plus of those stories. And they're amazing stories. Ah, the wonders of a distributed mind. in the Los Angeles area, KNX Radio runs some of the X-1 shows on there. They do an old radio segment, I think, each day, and a different kind each day. X-1 pops up periodically.
I should think so.
They pop up every now and again, but God, they were good.
They were very good. There was a similar thing in television. The BBC did a whole series of television adaptations of actual real science fiction stories, including a couple of mine and a lot of famous ones like The Machine Stops. I remember that because I happened to be in London and I watched them filming part of that.
Ooh. What was that series?
I don't remember the name of it. It was BBC. But they didn't want to spend extra money for the tapes, so they taped over them for their new shows. They're all gone now. But they were really a good job. They never appeared in America because BBC was doing them in black and white. And about that time, American television no longer wanted anything to do with anything that was in black and white. So they never came here. But I saw a few of them in England. I never saw my own. They promised to show them to me if I'd come to the BBC headquarters, but I needed to notify them a month ahead of time so they could get them out of the archives. But now the archives are history, too. I never will see them.
That happened to so much of the stuff done in that era. There were radio stations that would have archives of old radio drama on tape, and then they decided that they needed to record some interview about the county fair that week, so they'd tape over some old radio drama,
yeah.
Or they just throw the tape out. And it's just astonishing. There are these wonderful things that people have done that just get lost.
And no longer exist, and the present generation of people will never know them.
Yeah. That seems to be an issue, if not a problem, for the science fiction field. Because I see a lot of people coming into science fiction now, or in the last few years, and there's this whole body of work that they've never experienced.
Yes. Well, you're touching on an area that I am deeply scarred about. Books do not stay in print.
I know.
They should, but they don't. And the reason they don't is that there's this stupid tax law that says that if a publisher keeps a book in print, he has to pay taxes on it as an asset at some fictitious valuation.
Yeah.
And that gets too expensive.
And that's a relatively new change in the tax code.
About 10
years. 10 years, yeah. It's about 10 years ago that the...
Yeah. It used to be a publisher could keep a book in print because it took a little shelf space is all. Now it costs some money for the IRS.
Yeah.
And this is a bad thing because there are writers who should be in print and aren't. I don't think there's much of Theodore Sturgeon in print, and he was one of the greatest writers we ever had.
Also, Alfred Bester.
Alfie Bester is
until just recently.
Yeah.
Someone, they started doing some trade paperback reissues of his thing. And
there are a couple small companies which have gone into that business. And but how they deal with it, I don't know. But
I think
God bless them. I'm delighted they're there.
You know, I think 5 years ago, I was looking for an Alfred Bester book. You could not find it in Los Angeles.
I believe
it. And I was calling around to use bookstores, and there was no one that had them. Just absolutely no one had them. You know, there were no new editions, and no one was putting their old editions out into the used bookstores. You could not find an Alfred Bester book anywhere. And then apparently a few of them popped up, and then these reprints started showing up. And I think what happened was the reprints showed up, and then some people got rid of their older copies or something, which I don't understand. Maybe this is a place where new technology can come in and help.
Well,
you know, the print on demand.
Yes, but the thing is, I've been hearing for 40 years, at least 40 years, about print on demand and the electronic publishing and all that. And it just doesn't really happen. I mean, it does exist, but it doesn't do much for the writer. It's very rare for an e-book to make any money for the writer. If you're dependent on them for a living, you live very sparsely.
Yeah.
The technology has been around for a long time, and it just isn't happening.
Mm.
I think it's because people like the feel of a book.
Well, I wasn't thinking of an electronic book, because I hate reading on screen. I hate reading on screen.
Yeah.
I will do it.
Print on demand.
But yeah, print on demand, what I'm thinking about is addressing that warehousing tax. Because, you know, they don't tax you for having a text file in a computer yet.
Yes. Well, but when you print on demand, you're not getting the kind of book you would get from a hardcover, from a paper printing cover. You don't have the art in the cover, and you don't have the binding and all that stuff. You get something that looks like a notebook that somebody has written the story in. And maybe technology will take care of that at some point, but I'm not confident that they will do it very rapidly. So I think that the real solution is to get that law changed. And how you do that, I don't know. My wife ran for Congress 5 or 6 years ago. Didn't win. But if she had won, I would have been the first thing she tried to get passed in Congress.
I mean, it's almost like the change in the tax code was an assault on our cultural memory. You know, because books go away quickly.
You have to remember that the people who write tax codes are not a lot more sensible than science fiction editors. They have the same flaws in the upper story. A few years ago, they rewrote the tax code to show that every writer of any kind would have to, I forget what the word is, not amortize, but something like that, all of his expenses over the life of his product. So that, for example, if you had to travel to Antarctica to research an article you were writing, you could deduct the expenses of that trip, but only over the length of the copyright, which is to say now about 100 years. So you could only deduct 1/100th of it each year, which would not really help you because he wouldn't be alive for 100 years. But this somebody did inadvertently put it in the tax code, and the Authors Guild had to go to a lot of trouble to get them to rewrite that. I went to Washington a couple of times to testify on it, and every congressperson or assistant editor, executive assistant I talked to said, no, that's wrong, it's stupid, it should never have been, and we should change it. And it still took 2 years, and it cost the Authors Guild almost $200,000 to get it made right. But the people who make laws do not really understand what it's like to be a writer. They probably don't want to know, but they do writers a lot of inadvertent damage, in addition to the advertent damage they do.
Yeah. It's a challenge sometimes to decide if they're aiming at you or if they're just hitting you by accident.
Yes, it is.
And I'm not sure which is worse.